Maar de werkelijkheid is natuurlijk totaal anders.
Verander dat nou. Probeer daar nou in te grijpen. En ga niet meteen denken dat je...
Blijven we brullen of gaan we iets doen?
Dan moet je dat dus veranderen. Dat is dan de strekking van het verhaal wat ik ophaal.
Mag het ergens over gaan?
Mag het ergens over gaan?
Mag het ergens over gaan?
Zeg, mag het ergens over gaan?
Mag het ergens over gaan? Mag het ergens over gaan? Mag het ergens over gaan?
Hartelijk welkom bij deze aflevering van het praatprogramma Mag het ergens over gaan? In dit programma, dat elke zondag te beluisteren is, komen mensen aan het woord uit heel verschillende achtergronden, maar ze hebben allemaal één ding gemeen, ze zijn het gewend om na te denken. Het thema van dit programma is verandering en ik hoop dat we door dit programma een beeld krijgen van de kansen die deze tijd waarin alles lijkt te bewegen ons biedt. Dit programma wordt vandaag opgenomen in de herenkamer van het Fundatiehuis van Tijdens Museum en dat is een hele passende locatie omdat hier in dit museum al sinds de tijd van de verlichting vragen zijn gesteld en beantwoord die hebben bijgedragen tot een beter begrip van de wereld om ons heen. De uitzending van vandaag wijkt af van de gebruikelijke uitzendingen van dit programma en wel om twee redenen. Ik heb vandaag twee gasten aan tafel en het interview zal in het Engels gehouden worden. En dat laatste houdt direct verband met de nationaliteit van mijn twee gasten. Want zij zijn Lester Brown uit de Verenigde Staten en Paul Gilding uit Australië. Lester Brown is directeur van het Earth Policy Institute en heeft 50 titels op zijn naam staan van boeken waarvan de vertaling van zijn recentste boek Full Planet, Empty Plates deze week is uitgekomen. Paul Gilding was ooit directeur van Greenpeace en is nu onafhankelijk schrijver en adviseur op het gebied van duurzaamheid. Zijn recentste boek The Great Disruption kwam onder de titel Helden uit Noodzaak vorig jaar uit in het Nederlands. Ze zijn beide deskundig op het gebied van wat zich aan grote crisis op dit moment afspeelt in de wereld. Ze schrijven over de klimaatcrisis, de voedselcrisis, de energiecrisis en brengen deze crisis in hun boeken in verband met elkaar. De boodschap in hun beide recentste boeken, The Great Disruption en Full Planet Empty Plates van Lester Brown, is geen vrolijke, maar het is wel een boodschap die gehoord moet worden. En daarom zitten ze vandaag voor het eerst in hun leven gezamenlijk bij mij aan tafel. Welkom. Did you get any of that?
No.
None of that? Only nice things. I just explained very roughly to our audience about the content of both of your books. And the message that you're trying to get across is not a cheerful one, but it's one that needs to be told. Have you read each other's books?
I'm certainly familiar with Lester's work over many years. I mean, this is a man who's done more in this area of food policy than anybody else in the world.
Okay. What about you, Lester? Have you read Paul's book?
I've read part of it.
Okay. In what aspect are your books different? Why are the topics different, Paul?
I guess that my focus has recently, in the last few decades, been very much on the business and economic implications of this, looking at the whole range of issues that are impacted by, Lester's term, full planet. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm thinking through how does this change in terms of markets? How do we change the economy to suit the reality that Lester is talking about in terms of resource constraint and in particular food as being one of the major issues that, I agree will be the kind of the trigger for the great disruption that I'm talking about.
Okay. And your book, as Paul said, is mainly about the food crisis, the way things are heading.
The latest book is about the food crisis and, makes the argument that as our civilization gets into more and more trouble, which it is on so many fronts, from soil erosion to climate change and everything in between, it looks to me and Paul as well as though the food sector is going to be the weak link. This is where we're going to be in trouble first. I think we are already in trouble now. I mean, we sort of blame it on the drought in the U.S. This past summer. These are the kinds of climate events that will now become routine, not just rare occurrences. And it presents a new challenge for the world's farmers. The world's farmers have always had to deal with the vagaries of weather, but not with climate change, which neither they nor anyone else can confidently project insofar as it will affect them. So it's a new world in a sense, and we're not feeling very secure in it.
Okay, so how bad are things? If we say like 12 is the time that it's too late to act, what time is it?
Well, if I think it's already past midnight in a sense. I mean, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
We're in trouble. And the question now is can we work our way out of this? And it will require an enormous effort in a very short period of time. I use the World War II analogy in the U.S. and when in 1942 we totally restructured the U.S. industrial economy, partly because President Roosevelt banned the sale of cars. So all the automobile companies were producing tanks and planes on assembly lines. That's how we mobilized for World War II and did it very quickly. But it did take a total restructuring of the energy economy. We're now faced with the need to totally restructure the energy economy, move from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy, like wind and solar and geothermal. It's entirely doable. The technologies are there, but it's going to take a huge mobilization.
And I think it's important to recognize, as Lester says, we are past midnight in terms of it's too late to prevent a crisis. That doesn't mean it's too late, as in there's no point doing things. We are going to respond, but it is now going to require a warlike mobilisation, as both of us say in our books, in terms of the response. And that means it's not the end of the world, it's not the end of civilization, unless we choose that, which we certainly could choose that, but I think we're much more likely to be sensible in the end. And unfortunately, as we frequently do, and World War II is a good example of leaving it very late in the process, not too late to act, but too late to do it smoothly.
Okay, for people who are not familiar with the metaphor that you're using about the Second World War, the entire U.S. industrialization was reformed because of the Second World War. Government was saying you have to make war crafts, you have to make weapons instead of cars, right? And that's what they did. They had no choice, so that's what was done.
Right. Once President Roosevelt banned the sale of cars, it became clear, pretty clear to the automobile industry what they were going to have to do if they wanted to stay in business, basically. So they produced tanks and planes at an extraordinary rate. I think President Roosevelt, in his State of the Union address, January 6, 1942, that was a month after Pearl Harbor, which was December 7, 1941. That's when he laid out the goals. He said, we're going to produce 45,000 tanks, 60,000 planes. I mean, people couldn't even imagine numbers like that because in the U.S., remember, we were hoping not to get involved in the war. So we were just, you know, laying back and waiting. And then came the attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and we knew that we were in war.
And it's really important to understand just how dramatic that was in terms of a transformation in the whole economy. So the U.S. economy went from spending 1.6% of its GDP on military matters to 36% in 5 years. That's a dramatic transformation, not just about producing tanks and planes, but of the entire economy. And the fact that the government just said, well, sorry guys, but this is how we're doing it now. You have no choice but to be involved. That's the sort of economic transformation we're going to need as well.
Right, but it's going to be a worldwide transformation we need. So the State of the Union won't be enough. It will need to be a State of the Planet. So it needs, doesn't it need a global government to
no.
Right.
I mean, well,
explain.
Ideally, yes. But we haven't got one, so we can't do that.
No,
right?
Obviously.
I mean, if that would be good, if we have one, but we don't have one. So therefore, the reality is, again, it will be like World War II in the sense that it will be country by country joining in, allies forming in, alliances falling apart, coming together again. And that kind of chaotic process is how we'll do it. And we actually are seeing that today on climate. I mean, very early times. But the reality is China, the U.S., South Korea, you know, many countries are now acting in this area for different reasons with different motivations and not in a unified way, but in the generally same direction. And that's how I think this will be. So there will need to be a lot more diplomacy, a lot more focus of effort to try and unify the response. But I think if we wait for a world government or wait for a unified consensus position, we'll be waiting until it is too late. And so, and that's not how we do things. It's actually, there's no evidence that we behave like that generally. And there's no reason to think we're going to start now.
Yeah, let me just give an example of what Paul's saying. In the United States, the Sierra Club is leading an effort to close every coal-fired power plant in the United States. We have 492. They've succeeded in closing 121. But they plan to close every one. That's their goal, and they're a strong organization. And as a result, our carbon emissions are dropping very fast. From coal last year, they dropped 11%, and coal is the leading source of carbon emissions. our oil consumption is dropping as well, partly because young people are not part of the car culture, so they're not buying enough cars, so the fleet is beginning to shrink. But most importantly, we're increasing the efficiency of new cars every year. And they're actually going up much faster than programmed. That is, people are moving ahead of the regulations and automatically shifting to more efficient cars. And the manufacturers are all now producing much more efficient cars, trying to tap this this demand. So we're seeing coal use drop precipitously in the U.S., and we're seeing oil use drop steadily in the U.S. So our overall carbon emissions are coming down, and this is the largest economy in the world. So it's a major step forward.
Okay, but it's not at a rate that we should be cheering, and it's not that much of good news.
Well,
it's good news, but
but it is very significant still, because it shows what's possible. Up until now, it's been unimaginable that we could do that.
Mm.
Whereas now, what's happening is, you know, a bunch of foundations in the U.S., including Mayor Bloomberg, which I think is just fascinating, are putting money into this Sierra Club campaign against the coal plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing very large amounts of money and focus go into this campaign now. So it shows that that gives strength to the idea. So, yes, it's only a small step towards what we have to do, but it means that the big step we have to make is no longer inconceivable. And that's, I think, a very important
issue. Okay, I'll just be the devil's advocate. And if you're saying that it's dropping now, so people are starting to realize the importance, producers are starting to realize the importance, can't we just sit back and see it happens? It's going the right direction. What's wrong with that? Let's just wait and see what happens.
That would be the easy way to do it. But we have to move very fast. Climate change is not something that may happen. It is already happening. And we're seeing this in more destructive storms, more intense droughts. Probably the economic indicator that is going to signal change or difficulty on the climate front is rising food prices. Now, most people don't know the difference between 350 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere and 400 parts. I mean, they do know food prices, and they do respond to food prices. And that's where I think the battle will be engaged. It will be in trying to get the brakes on climate change fast enough so that it doesn't totally disrupt the world food economy.
And we learned from the Arab Spring that food prices are not just an inconvenience or a tragedy for people who haven't got enough food.
Mm-hmm.
It is all that, and it's a major political driver of change. So we are seeing already significant political instability as a result of food prices. So the response is not going to be because the world suddenly decides to care about people who are starving, unfortunately, although that would be enough motivation in its own right. The reality is we haven't responded to that significantly yet. But
That's if you rely on empathy.
Exactly. And what I'm saying is we're not going to do that fast enough, not for that level of change in consciousness in humanity.
Mm.
But we will respond if the Middle East falls apart and oil prices spike.
Mm-hmm.
We will respond if we get 300 million refugees roaming around India, Pakistan and China, causing conflict between countries. That's when we're going to respond. And the reality is that the response we then need, as Lester says, is so dramatic, you can't possibly leave it to natural market processes.
Mm-hmm.
No, so, for example, to have an 80% chance of not going past 2 degrees, which is the limit that everyone agrees is the outermost possible limit we can go for.
What happens when temperature rises with 2 degrees?
Over time, what would happen is it would get up to 4 metres of sea level rise, right, over several hundred years, but with quite a bit of that in the first 100 years. So
will we still exist in Holland?
Well, it depends on how good you are at these dikes. I mean, so far it's looking pretty good for you in terms of having a global marketplace for dike building.
Okay.
But you can't put dikes around the world. You know, you can around Holland, but I think there is a big issue there in terms of restructuring the economy to recognise that some areas can be defended and some areas can't.
Mm-hmm.
And the expense of doing that is going to be a very big issue. But 2 degrees means metres of sea level rise over time. It means major impacts on the global food supply. It means the end of coral reefs pretty much globally. And it means a lot of extreme weather, remembering it's more than twice as hard as we've gone so far.
So if you say it's the end of coral reefs, maybe except for the people that are scuba diving, why is that a big loss?
So the two issues. One is that's more symbolic of how large the system changes are.
Mm.
So coral reefs is a symbolic example of the impact. But the practical example of the impact is loss of biodiversity, loss of fisheries, loss of food supply in a whole range of areas. Mm. So these impacts are things that I think we can arguably respond to and manage, but we can't go beyond that point. And to not go beyond that point requires us to eliminate fossil fuel use in the economy in about 20 years.
Okay.
Right, and 20 years to take out the coal, oil and gas industries from the economy is quite a significant task.
Yes.
And we can do that using the World War II example.
You're looking at Leicester now. Two of you can do that. Well, yeah.
because the task is I'm looking at Leicester because this is the World War II example.
Okay.
You know, that we can do extraordinary transformations when we choose to do so, but we have to make that big decision first.
However, these noises that are being made now by you, the 2% thing, they've been told over and over again for the past, what, 2-3 decades, that it's really, there's a sense of urgency that's been growing for the past few decades. People haven't done much yet. How urgent does it need to be?
Yeah, I think, again, food prices is going to be the bottom line here. And what we're now seeing in the world is not just a spread of hunger, but a deepening of hunger. And there are now a number of countries where people routinely plan foodless days simply because they cannot afford to eat every day. Mm-hmm. We see this in Nigeria, for example. 27% of the families in Nigeria now plan foodless days. This is a real deepening of hunger. In India, 24% of families plan foodless days. That is, they get together on Sunday night and say, well, we're going to only eat 5 days this week, so we'll skip Wednesday and Saturday, mm-hmm. for example. This is a new chapter in the evolution of the world food economy, where we're looking at the addition of 80 million people each year. That means that at the dinner table tonight, there will be 219,000 people who were not there last night. So population growth has been with us a long time, but that's still there. And then we have water shortages. Mm-hmm. All the major food-producing countries, the big three, China, India, and the United States, are over-pumping their aquifers. Mm-hmm. And you can do that until the wells go dry. But overpumping is, by definition, a short-term phenomenon.
And the aquifers, for people that are not familiar with this term, are the underground water supplies, the streams that...
Right. Right, this is water that nature stores underground.
And there's two kinds of aquifers. There's the superficial aquifers that refill themselves and the...
Yeah, we would call them renewable aquifers, rechargeable aquifers, mm-hmm. where rainfall keeps recharging. Then there are fossil aquifers. Mm-hmm. This is water that was laid down eons ago in geological time. Saudi Arabia, for example, was irrigating with a fossil aquifer. Mm-hmm. They were self-sufficient in wheat for 30 years, even though the country's just a big desert. But that aquifer was their lifeline. But that aquifer's almost gone now. And in another couple years, they'll be out of the wheat-growing business altogether. So the water issue is a major one. The World Bank estimates that in India, 175 million people are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. Mm-hmm. So you have to wonder about those 175 million when their wells go dry. That's what overpumping means. Then we have China with, I estimate, 120 million people being fed by overpumping. So this is a major cloud hanging over the future of food security, mm-hmm. just the water one. So we have climate, which threatens food security. We have water, and we have record growth in demand, because in addition to population, we estimate there are now about 3 billion people in the world moving up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive livestock products. Mm-hmm. So the annual growth in the demand for grain over the last decade has doubled, mm-hmm. from 21 million tons a year to 41 million tons a year, at a time when farmers are beginning to struggle to keep up. So that's why we're seeing higher food prices, and why we're going to see still higher food prices in the future.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I think that food is so critical in this context is that we must see it as an economic issue, mm-hmm. right? That we know the climate problem, mm-hmm. we know how to fix it, and that we can. We just have to decide to do so. Now, therefore, we're looking for the trigger, and people look for the trigger as being extreme climate events like Sandy or New York, which I think, you know, helps people to understand it. But food is the economic trigger. So if Lester's right, which I think he is, about the food crisis coming any year now, then if we understand that to be a climate-driven issue, and because of this economic impact, that could be the trigger that forces the world to have this dramatic response. Because remembering, we know what to do, we know how to do it, and there's actually a lot of good news in doing it. Like the benefits that we have of fixing this problem are quite dramatic. The idea of energy security in every country, no wars over oil, you know, cleaner cities. You know, there's a whole bunch of benefits that come from this process that make our economy stronger and our communities more resilient. So it's not like, this is not like a war in the sense that we're going to suffer, you know, as a result of declaring war. We're going to suffer from not declaring war. And when we declare war, life starts to get better. And that I think is an important context, because the hopefulness in the crisis, if you like, is that the response is almost purely beneficial in terms of the improvements that we make to our society and to global society in terms of equality and so on.
Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things happening in the world today is in China. The Chinese are becoming scared of coal because of what it's translating into. They've launched an enormous wind development program where they'll have 8 wind mega complexes, each of which is already under construction. The minimum generating capacity of each of those is 20,000 megawatts. Think 20 nuclear power plants, and you have 8 of these complexes. Mm-hmm. The largest is in Inner Mongolia near the border with Gansu. When it's completed, it will have 38,000 megawatts of generating capacity. Mm-hmm. This is wind. And just to put that in focus, that's enough electricity to satisfy the needs of a country like Poland. So it's not trivial. This is huge. We've not seen in the energy sector before, with nuclear, coal, or anything else, scaling up like this. It is huge and beyond anything we could have imagined.
Is it a hopeful start, or is it more than that?
It's more than that. It's going to be a large share of their electricity when they get these finished. This is China. Taking this huge step to build wind farms far larger than the world had ever imagined, and 8 of them, huge wind-generating complexes. So that's the exciting sort of thing that's happening in the world.
And the reason that's so exciting, apart from the fact that this is a massive scale, is that if you deploy technologies on this scale, the prices come down dramatically. Right. So what it means is that because of this deployment, we're kind of looking for technology all the time as though we need some new discovery. What we need is deployment, so the delivery of existing technologies.
We need to implement the techniques that are already there, that we've already developed, into on a large scale.
Correct. And doing so transforms that industry for the world. Right. So what's happening in solar at the moment is it's the deployment of solar on rooftops in America, manufactured in China, that is changing the economics of solar everywhere. And so this is why this kind of example is so important. It's not just important for China.
Okay.
It's important for the whole world's capacity to go to renewables much
like
faster.
Like everything is important to everything else in the world.
Correct.
Right now, in global.
This
all sounds very helpful and very it makes sense. It makes sense. This is the way it should go. However, I think you have talked to some people at the Shell, maybe the great fuel providers, are they aware of the fact that this is the way to go?
Look, it's a really interesting dynamic that I've observed recently, but also if you look at historically how this occurs, is that almost every industry that is challenged or threatened by a major transformation stays in denial as long as they possibly can, right? And the history of markets is that most companies don't make major transformations. And we hear very earnest statements of support from companies like Shell, as you mentioned, who absolutely understand the climate science, have no denial about the climate science or the importance of acting, and yet have a business strategy.
They drill even deeper.
Which drills deeper and goes harder and leverages the melting of the Arctic for their own commercial benefits. Okay. So we have this incredible contradiction. But I think that's okay. That's how we do these things historically. So what that means is most companies like Shell and Exxon simply won't make it in the transition because they won't be ready for the scale of change. It's not denial about the science. It's denial about our capacity to transform markets that fast. And this is okay. This is how markets work. If you look at the history of transformation on little things like digital photography, most of the old companies don't make it. right? And if you look at markets today, look at the Dow Jones Index or any number of global stock market indices, and you see the component companies of those indices are almost entirely different than they were 30 or 40 years ago, and that's what we're going to do, but much faster.
But, Paul, if you look at the photography business you talked about, it's the Kodak example that you're using. Why are they not growing up? If Shell uses the logistics that are already there and all the lines they've already got to supply energy and everything, they just change the source of the energy. Mm. Wouldn't that make a lot more sense?
Sure, and they could, and they should, and they won't. Because the reality is that this is not how companies behave. I mean, some do. There are some 200-year-old companies around like DuPont that transform over time, but they're very rare.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a human reality is that, you know, if you're just picking on Shell because we're in the Netherlands, as an example, you know, the reality is they are making enormous amounts of money now on a strategy which involves us going to 4 or 5 degrees centigrade, right? So to actually, if they didn't pursue that strategy, the people in charge of the company would be removed and replaced by people who would. And people who can't live with that strategy leave.
Right.
So it becomes a self-selecting process of the people who are in there today, and this is not just Shell, this is, of course, every oil company. You really can't stay in there if you understand the consequences of the strategy. So therefore it self-selects the people who can live with that contradiction. Not because they're evil people at all.
They've got children.
They've got children, they're smart people, they understand the climate science, but just the dynamics of the market drive them in a certain direction. Now, the good news for us is that markets deal with that very effectively, right, by sending them broke at the right time.
Okay.
Right, and therefore that's okay. That's not, I mean, we'll have jobs, we'll have an economy, we just won't have this economy. And that's why I think it's important not to kind of panic about that process, but not to expect them to self-destruct. Mm-hmm. We have to kind of destroy them as opposed to them self-destructing with love and compassion. But we
lovely destruction.
Yeah, we have to do it in a way which that's how markets work.
Death. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. In a way, though, if you look at the average consumer, like if you bring it back to the human level, if I look at myself, I still go shopping, even though I know that I don't need all that stuff that I'm buying. I'm not buying that much. I've got a really small footprint when it comes to that. Anyway, but still, I do buy stuff and that I don't need. I'm very aware of the things that are happening. I look around me. Still, I do the same thing. I put my blinders on when it's convenient. How do you address us, the consumers? How do you address me?
I've got a whole chapter in my book on this fascinating issue about, you know, I call it the end of shopping. Which in many ways for people is more distressing than the end of climate change or a food crisis. But the kind of reality is that this is a relatively temporary phenomena in civilization, that we're so obsessed with materialism, consumerism, right? But it comes from a kind of healthy place, and we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves about where it comes from, because if you were living in a cave and didn't have enough food and winter was coming, then consuming and purchasing and holding for bad times was a natural human process. And our genes are kind of programmed to behave in that way. We've just got really carried away, right? So we have to recognise that we are going to change, but we're going to have to be forced to change. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that we're being forced to change today is that the economy is not as healthy. So therefore, we haven't got as much money. Therefore, we're being forced into consuming in a different way by the natural process of just lack of supply of money. And I think that's a really interesting development, because I think that level of change in culture can only happen when you're forced to change by the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
It's not likely to happen through a kind of sudden rising consciousness, unfortunately, much as I'd like it to be. It's going to happen because we haven't enough money, because things will get too expensive, the government will regulate in a variety of ways, and entrepreneurs and innovators will create new ways of making us happy with less stuff.
There are some technological trends at work here too. Among young people, when I was growing up, the way you socialized was when you're 17, you got a driver's license, you got a car, and especially if you live in a rural area, if you want to see other people, you have to drive.
And you live in the States as well, because we have to wait until we're 18.
Okay, yeah, we're in the U.S. now, but today's young people, being mostly urban, we're 82% urban now, don't socialize with automobiles. It's smartphones and it's the internet. It's Facebook. It's these. This is how they communicate with each other. And it's not a very energy intensive way of life. Living without cars, we see in the U.S. now the novelty of bike share programs, for example. Washington, D.C. is the leader, but there are 26 other cities now doing this, and within a month or two, New York and Chicago will join in this with huge bike share programs. So, I mean, that's not a novel thing here in the Netherlands where everyone rides bikes. But in the U.S. it is. It represents progress in the U.S. And it's a major shift.
Yeah, but it does. This is interesting because you say it shows progress in the United States, a sense of understanding and maybe a paradigm shift. But if you look at China, the last time I looked is that they're building highways and they're building and just everybody wants their car and so maybe if it's a good thing in the US, but
they're beginning to change direction. I remember doing a seminar at Tsinghua University in Beijing and talking about the future, and I was making the point that their future would not be the American lifestyle. And one of the graduate students said, you know, but we all want to have a car too. I said, well, if you ever succeed in having three cars for every four families, as we do in the United States, it will not be a dream. It will be a nightmare because you'll have a billion cars, more than in the world today. Can you imagine what the traffic would be like? And then they began to understand that maybe a car in every garage was not the model for their future. I mean, even for Americans, this model is not working anymore. Our car fleet is shrinking. Young people are not buying cars. It's a major social shift, and I think it's going to be driven by economics. I think it's going to be driven by fuel costs. I think it's going to be driven by social concerns. One of the things associated with a car culture like the United States is a lack of exercise. So we have one of the most serious obesity problems in the world. When people ride bikes, I don't see many obese people, you know, riding
around. We've got a few.
Are there?
Big bikes. Yeah.
I haven't seen many of them. Certainly not like in the United States. So there are health concerns. There are air quality concerns. There are congestion concerns and how much time you want to spend, you know, sitting in traffic jams and when commuting to work and so forth. So there are a lot of things coming together in the United States and elsewhere to reshape things. I mean, it's interesting here in Europe now to see that there are three states in northern Germany that get between 40% and 50% of their electricity from wind farms. That's a major step in the right direction. In the U.S., we have two states, Iowa and South Dakota, that get 20% of their electricity from wind farms. But these are sort of windows into the future as to where the world is headed.
Are we expecting from developing countries, developing economics, that they grow up faster than we did? Because we took all the steps, step by step. We grew. And now they want to grow, but they have to realize that there's an end to their... there's a limit to what they can actually do. So they have to grow up faster than we ever did. Is that a fair thing to ask from them?
Now, one of the things we need to do now is to ask a very basic question, which is, if you're designing an economy for the 21st century, what would it look like? Not the 20th century. That's history now. And the answer is it would be a very different world. For example, consider national security. In Washington, you talk about national security, and people automatically think of advanced weapon systems, a bigger military budget. But I don't think armed aggression is the principal threat to our security in this century. It might have been the last century, but not this one. I mean, there were two world wars in the last century and a Cold War. I think the threats to our security now are climate change, population growth, food shortages, rising food prices, growing political instability. Armed aggression doesn't make the top five on my list of threats in the 21st century, threats to our security. So we need to redefine security, not just in an intellectual sense, but in a fiscal sense, and begin redistributing resources toward the development of renewable energy sources, for example, to developing fuel-efficient urban transport systems. Mm-hmm. We have to begin thinking as though we are in the 21st century, mm-hmm. and to think about what things should look like, how we should plan things, how to design things.
Lester, who do we want in that Pentagon then? If you make that metaphor, if national security is different from in the 21st century than it was in the 20th century, and the Pentagon is filled with people that know everything about warfare, who do we want in the Pentagon in the 21st century? Farmers? Engineers?
I don't think the reform is going to come from within the Pentagon. I mean, they like to talk about new threats to security, and they'll talk about climate change, which means we need to have more military bases in Africa. Mm. I mean, that's sort of the way they translate it. So they act as though they're concerned about climate change, but they're only using it to strengthen. The military-industrial complex intends to preserve itself. That's its goal. And it's a very entrenched. I mean, it's a well-designed system. There is in every one of the states in the United States a military manufacturing facility, mm-hmm. guns or planes or whatever. So there's a political link between the Pentagon now and the Congress members from each congressional delegations from each state. So, but I think we're going to break out of that. We're beginning to. And we could see some enormous change. Okay. And especially as we bring the troops back from Afghanistan, as we're now planning to do, and then suddenly we won't have these wars, we hope, that we've been fighting for the last decade, which we shouldn't have been fighting in the first place. Iraq was just an effort to keep the military-industrial complex alive.
Okay. I couldn't agree more. That's what I'm doing. I wanted a guest here who said, if you want to change the economic thing we're in Europe right now, what you should really do is take all the debts and all the money that you have and put it on one big pile, remove the debts and see what's left over, and then
set new priorities.
Well, yeah.
Allocate with
reshuffle, redistribute the money, like mm-hmm. every country, a certain amount of money. Let's start all over again. Mm-hmm. Wipe slate clean. Is there something thinkable, a system like that, or a weird thought like that, that is that you can apply to this crisis that we're heading now, the food crisis?
I do think there is a real possibility of very significant shift, system shift. Yeah?
Right.
So like you can really imagine a crisis big enough mm-hmm. that suddenly only that level of dramatic shift gives us a solution.
Mm-hmm.
So I think debt is a huge issue. And I describe this as being trapped in the sort of debt growth trap,
mm-hmm.
that if we don't grow the economy, we can't pay off the debt. Right. If we do grow the economy, we're going to suffer so much in terms of food price spikes, oil price spikes, and resource constraint,
mm-hmm.
as argued by economists and financiers like Jeremy Grantham, that we're going to suffer. The economy is going to suffer. So we're sort of trapped. Mm-hmm. So we need a big solution. We need a big idea, and one of those is about debt.
That was a big idea.
We have to
kind
of wipe off the debt, basically. Right. I mean, we effectively need to have a default.
Mm-hmm.
We need to recognise this system is unsustainable and we can't trade our way out of difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Effectively, the world is insolvent, right? We can't afford to pay our debts as they come due in a financial sense or in a food sense,
mm-hmm.
right? So we need to kind of reset. We need to kind of declare Chapter 11 bankruptcy in US terms and do a restructuring.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those restructurings is about wiping off debt, but it's also recognising that future economic activity is going to have to be in new areas. Now, if we take out the fossil fuel industry from the economy, that is trillions of dollars of activity,
mm-hmm.
which on one hand you think, well, that's a major crisis for the global economy.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a major opportunity for the global economy, because if you've got to build a new energy economy, if you have to restructure cities and make every house and every building more energy efficient,
mm-hmm.
right, if you've got to redo the way we do food production,
mm-hmm.
right, that is going to create a lot more jobs and a lot more economic activity
mm-hmm.
than the oil, coal and gas industries currently do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of thinking shift we need, is how do we create the jobs?
Yeah.
You know, how do we shift the tax burden, for example, from people towards stuff like green taxes? So, those very simple ideas, like we need more jobs. Unemployment is a huge social crisis in the West and in developing countries, and yet most of our taxation systems focus on taxing employment, right, and free amounts of stuff. What we should do is tax a lot less on employment and tax a lot more on stuff to try and get the economy to move away from stuff consumption and waste and move towards job creation.
Yeah, the key here is to tax labor less and tax carbon more. And then that would begin to do the restructuring that would create a more labor-intensive economy, among other things. But I don't know if you've ever gone by an oil refinery, you know, all the things and stuff. You never see any people there, you know? I mean, it's not a very labor-intensive operation, whereas the new sources of energy, whether it's wind farms or solar farms or geothermal energy, they're enormous employment opportunity for building that system to begin with, then maintaining it once we get built. But that's clearly the way the world should be moving now, and we're seeing dramatic examples of it here and there in different places. Iceland, for example, is now getting virtually all of its electricity from either geothermal or hydropower, all renewable. They want to drop a cable to the UK to sell geothermally generated electricity. I mean, they've got an endless amount almost, and so this is an obvious thing for them to share with the rest of the world.
So actually the economic crisis is one of the biggest chances if I... It is.
No, the economic crisis is a huge opportunity for for two reasons. One is we need to do something, right? We're kind of stuck in this place. We need to move on from it, so we need some big ideas about that. But I think perhaps more importantly in terms of its short-term impact is up until the economic crisis, we kind of believed that the market was immortal, that the market would always solve every problem, that the system would always self-correct, and the globalized market was like the highest form of human civilization just after shopping. And that kind of idea, which was around just 4 or 5 years ago, is now dead, right? People recognize that we have a system problem. And once you recognize you have a system problem, you're much more open to big ideas about the solutions. But we had to kind of go through this process where the kind of masters of the universe of shopping and markets, right, had to face up to their own kind of mortality and recognize not only can we afford to have a new way, we have to have a new way if we want to keep progressing as a civilization.
Something else. There is this. We're just talking about a global government, which does not exist. However, there is this intergovernmental. A panel on climate change, IPCC. The IPCC. There has been a lot of rumors about that the facts weren't correct, and this is, of course, is ammunition for the people who are very much opposed to changing everything, and they've got a lot of stakes in keeping things the way they are, and they attacked this reports of the IPCC, and they got a valid point in attacking that. What happened there, and why did it go wrong?
It's a really interesting phenomena, and one we've seen at other points in history where the vested interests who have a lot to lose can be very effective at giving the appearance of conflict and debate. The reality is there is just no conflict in the science community about climate change. There is just none. I mean, it doesn't exist. There is no group of credible scientists in this area who disagrees. It's like 98%. This is up there with gravity, you know, in terms of scientific proof. So, not quite, but you get my point.
Or maybe evolution.
Yeah, well, evolution probably is a more interesting example in the US context.
Darwin and Einstein are true.
The point of that is don't be confused by that. Right. We recognise that that's just we're having a bad day, right? And recognise that we'll get over that point because in the end we are rational people and in the end we are going to look at the facts. And there have been many times in history where we've believed things that are kind of stupid for a long time and then woken up to the reality. And the joy of this one is this is not a philosophical debate. This is not a debate about ideas. This is a debate about physics and chemistry and biology. Right, and the rules, you know, Mother Nature doesn't negotiate. The rules sort of are just there, and there's consequences. So it doesn't matter how long we stay in denial, the climate keeps changing. And eventually that physical change overcomes that resistance.
Is there enough media attention for reports like this? Would you say there's enough media attention? Because if I look at the newspaper and I see this report, like a few weeks ago, there was this somebody who said like, well, you know what? The climate change, it isn't as bad as we thought. I mean, it's not, the temperatures aren't rising as fast as they are. I read those kind of articles, not every week, but pretty more than these kind of articles.
What the media has done a good job with is reporting on these mega climate disasters like the heat wave and drought in the U.S. Mm-hmm. That's still ongoing. There's now a question whether there'll be enough rainfall between now and April to plant corn in the Midwest, for example. Mm-hmm. And our wheat crop is that we have planted in the last month or two is in the worst condition of any crop on record. The record goes back for 50 years or so. Mm-hmm. So what we did not see or what we did not hear during the intense drought of this past summer was the climate deniers. They kind of went back into the woodwork. You know, mm-hmm. they weren't out there. And then came Hurricane Sandy. And again, you know, we didn't hear anything from them. I think the climate deniers are in full retreat now. And I think in the United States, at least, where we've been behind the curve on this issue, I think we're very close to a tipping point mm-hmm. on the climate mm-hmm. issue. Mm-hmm. And once you reach these tipping points, then everything changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of like when the Berlin Wall came down. That was the visual manifestation mm-hmm. of major political change in every country in Eastern Europe. So as these major climate events occur with increasing frequency, I think we're going to see recognition of a need for response. I mean, not just fine tuning, but some very basic changes. I think it's probably going to drive the shift from internal combustion engines to plug-in hybrids and all-electric cars, for example, being powered by wind farms. And the exciting thing about electric motors is, as engineers know, they're about three times more efficient than internal combustion engines in converting energy into motion. So we're seeing a shift underway now. It has many dimensions. It has the price of gasoline. It has the attitudes of young people toward cars. It has the rethinking of urban transport systems. Just a host of things coming together. They're going to change the future.
It
of
just
oil.
Takes a lot of disasters to get through to people. Is that basically what's going on?
Yes, and keep in mind that the United States consumes more gasoline than the next 20 countries combined. Mm-hmm. So what happens in the United States is important in this area.
And it's already dropping, as you said. Dropping. Yes.
But I think it's not just disasters. I think it's important not to get too focused on just the extreme climate events.
They help.
They certainly help, but you wouldn't kind of want to wait for more data. More data isn't going to change the debate. Mm. It'd be like going to Al-Qaeda with an economic analysis of the benefits of Western civilization. You know, it would not help, right? Because if you don't want to believe, then evidence doesn't actually change your attitude. Mm-hmm. However, the great mass of evidence over time, moving through the business community, moving into economics, I think is a critical thing. The reason the food crisis that Lester talks about coming is so important is because it will have an economic impact on the global economy. Mm-hmm. Right, and that's actually a lot more significant in terms of triggering change mm-hmm. than physical climate disasters.
Well, however, though, I think I spent about, I don't know exactly, about 11% of my total budget on food. Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, it's not pleasant. They sure. have to pay more, but it's I can see it up
for
now. Well.
But you're not the trigger.
I'm not respect. The trigger.
It's like the Arab Spring, you know, is because the people of Egypt spend 50%.
Okay.
Of their income on food, so that's where
I lean back and say, well, tough for them.
Yeah, well, no, except you won't, because well, you do what you choose to do.
No, well,
but you'll.
I could say that. I'm not saying that.
Of course,
I would.
You wouldn't. Yeah. But my point is though, it's not about the moral concern, right? My point is that these things trigger economic instability. Economic instability, and especially in oil-producing regions, and especially when you have large refugee flows and collapsing nation states.
Mm-hmm.
That gets our attention. And again, not for moral reasons, mm-hmm. but for economic reasons. And that is going to get a lot of attention.
That's going to hurt.
And if we relate that back to the climate crisis, mm-hmm. if we recognize that our whole system is being tipped over the edge, depleting aquifers and so on,
mm-hmm.
by the climate crisis, that's something we can fix pretty easily. And that's why I think that's going to be the trigger.
Okay. Okay. I'm just going to look at my technician. How many more?
10 minutes.
We still have 10 minutes?
Yes.
I promised the audience that they could ask some questions if they have any. So I would like to ask the audience if you have any questions for Paul. And yes, I would have to invite you over to this microphone to... is that okay?
That's okay.
Okay.
I was intrigued by the comparison with the World War II. And as the first Dutch astronaut, I would like to ask you to not only compare it with World War II, but also with the Apollo program. Mm. But then, you know, there was an urgency, there was a crisis, there was a capability, but there were 400,000 people working on it with an age less than, average age less than 30. So the question to you is, I mean, we're all older, you're a little less old than I am, but still, I mean, how do we mobilize young people, because they are the stakeholders of the future, and how can we make them change the things which we need to change?
Well, actually, young people are making some of the changes that we should have been making and doing it pretty rapidly. I mentioned in the U.S., the young people are not part of the car culture the way my generation was. That's already a major shift. We're seeing other changes in the youth culture, if you will. Diets are changing. Young people do not think about consuming beef the way our generation did. My generation, you know, you wanted to celebrate, you went out and you got a big steak, you know, so big it almost hung over the edge of the plate. I mean, this was a big deal. No one does that anymore. I mean, we've changed. In the U.S., meat consumption per person has dropped 11% in the last 6 years. So the U.S., as a whole, led by young people, is going through a dietary shift, a major one. And exactly where it will end up remains to be seen, but it's clearly well underway.
And the other thing we're seeing with young people is activism. It's a rebirth of a much more radical activism than we've seen for quite some time. And you know, Bill McKibben's 350.org at the moment is running a tour around US universities calling for the divestment in fossil fuels from all university endowment funds. Now, though, that's early days in that process, but the point is that there is much more direct action being taken in traditional activism, which will put pressure on governments, pressure on financial markets, and pressure on companies. You know, Greenpeace has a campaign against Shell drilling in the Arctic. You know, now has 2 million people joined up, you know, via the internet to join that campaign. So we're seeing a rekindling of activism in that old traditional style, which I think is a good sign in terms of their level of engagement.
I actually got a question for the gentleman that just asked a question to you, because he's the first Dutch astronaut, as he stated. His name is Wibbel Ockels. You're one of the few people that has actually seen the planet from above as a whole. Did that change your view on the things that were going on actually on the planet, or it must have done? What did it do to you?
Well, I feel like I'm going to have to grab time for
To
be very short, because I think we
should... Yeah,
but... The key issue is that once you are in space and you come back to the Earth, you realize it's not space that is unique, but it is the Earth. And there's only one. And that very Earth I always compare as a spaceship. And I always ask people to consider themselves as crew members, as astronauts of spaceship Earth, because if you realize that, that is your tool to survive. And the hull of spaceship Earth is not from strong steel. The hull of spaceship Earth is a thin layer of air which protects you against the dangers of space, because you can't live in space. Mm-hmm. Now, if you see it that way, that maybe just makes you a little more committed and also more proud of the position that you have. But in particular, I really like to motivate always young people with this story, because they feel that if they are an astronaut, they do something. And we have a good example here, because we have two young people who are starting to work on making the canals of Amsterdam sustainable.
Okay.
They will celebrate 400 years next year, and they have to live another 400 years. And if people work that way, that's absolutely great.
All right. Thank you very much. Any more questions from the audience? Yes.
Hi. Thanks for the possibility. I'd like to know, for practical reasons, it's very nice that you tell us all the theoretical things like the economies and stuff like that. But to convince people, not only the young people, but the grown-ups who are used to the old systems, that they should change rapidly, what would you advise to communicate to them instead of the more reasoning about the stuff, more the emotional stuff, I guess, you need to apply to?
So I think it's very important to recognise we're at a different point in this issue. Now that for 30 or 40 years we've talked about that we should change, right? That it's the right thing to do to change, that you'll be making a better contribution to the world if you change. And I guess what I'm writing about now is that we are going to change, right? We're going to have to change. We're going to be forced to a major restructuring of the economy. And therefore, at a personal level, the motivation is still doing the right thing, but it's also getting ready for what's coming, right? We're going to have less money. We're going to be able to buy less stuff. We're going to live in a less stable world. So the more we produce food locally, the more resilient our cities are, the more we get ready for that new world, the more secure we're going to be in that place. So we've kind of moved on from just having a moral imperative to action, and we now have a self-interest in acting to get ready for what's coming.
Yeah, the other thing is that young people eat dinner with their parents. And I don't know how many times over the years I've heard someone say, you know, my son, my daughter started talking about this and got me thinking about it. You know, Daddy, what is your company doing to cut carbon emissions or whatever? And it, when it comes from the youngsters, and the parents realize they're reflecting a generational concern, then things begin to happen. So if you can reach young people, some of that education will filter up via the dinner table and begin to change today. I mean, the key decision makers today are not young people. The corporate executives and political leaders are in our generation. But many of them are being changed by concerns that the next generation has.
Yes. We have to finish, unfortunately, we have to finish this conversation. I read both of your books, and the last words in Lester's book is, let's do it, it's time. And the last words, or no, in it's the other way around. In your book, it was, let's do it, it's time, in Paul's book. And Lester's book, it's, we know what we have to do, it's up to you and me to do it. Now, let's assume that everybody sitting here, that they got the message. And everybody that's listening tonight, they get the message. We get up tomorrow. What do we do? What can we change in a very small micro thing that would actually help and could build out to be something bigger?
It's actually two things. It's a lifestyle change, what I can do personally, whether it's how I travel or my diet or what have you. But the most important thing is to become politically active. We've got to change the system, and we've got to do it quickly, not 20 or 50 years from now. We've got to do it now. And it takes a lot of political action to bring about these changes. If you were to ask me, I mean, people often ask, you know, what can I do? And they expect me to say, recycle your newspapers or replace
Stop
your light
meat.
Bulbs. Those things are important, but we've got to change the system. That means becoming politically active and pushing for a carbon tax, for example, or what have you, things that can literally change the system in a major way.
And I would agree with that. And the way I would manifest that, apart from ringing your local political member and talking to them about what they need to do about it and that you care about it, talk to your friends about it. We've kind of got to this point where it's impolite to have, you know, conversations about how bad things are. And therefore,
you have no friends left when you do that.
Well,
all the time.
No, what I'm saying is we need to have that conversation, right? And if we all start doing it, we'll all start doing it,
okay.
Right? It's like it's a point where I don't mean haranguing your friends into changing, but recognizing that we're kind of a bit scared to say that we're scared about the future and need to change, right? And if we kind of all start doing that, we'll all start doing that, and that will change the thinking in our political system. So actively directing, you know, conversation amongst your community, at work, at home, in your school, whatever it is, to saying we need to change now, gives permission for everyone else to change. I think we have enough support in public opinion deep down We have a sense that something big is changing, and we need to get ready. But we need to kind of unleash that potential in the society, and that's what I think we need to do first.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Are you an optimist or a pessimist? In other words, is the planet half full or is it half empty?
My quick answer is I don't think of myself as an optimist or a pessimist, but as a realist.
Okay. That makes sense.
And I would say I'm a rational optimist in the sense that it is going to get ugly,
yeah,
right? And we have to face up to that reality that we're going to face some difficult times.
Yes.
But I'm hopeful and optimistic in the belief that we can get through that.
Okay.
And it's not just a naive hope. It's a practical hope built on our historical reality of our capacity to respond in crises and do extraordinary things.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be here today.
Correct. Yeah.
Exactly. We're Jets, the greatest. Yeah. Well, anyway, thanks very much for being here and talking to me. We zijn aan het eind gekomen van deze aflevering van Mag het ergens over gaan? De uitzending die we zojuist beluisterden is vanaf morgen na te luisteren op www.ziggyklaasens.nl en op YouTube. Volgende week zijn we weer terug in de grote herenkamer van Tijd.